I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to kick off Indie Talks by discussing health. We're going to talk about how healthy Hoosiers are, and we're going to talk about ways they can achieve better health. We're going to talk about problems and solutions. My guest will be Kim Irwin of Health by Design, Dr. Adrian Hutper, Vice President of Exercises Medicine, and Dr. Lisa Harris, Eskenazi Health CEO. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits at WFYI.org, finding us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or locating us on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
Is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu. And by Apparatus, supporting Big Brothers Big Sisters of Central Indiana during National Mentoring Month in January. More on how to become a Big Brother Big Sister or be a part of a big couple at bebigforkids.org.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are kicking off Indie Talks today. That's a community conversation about things that matter. And the thing that we're talking about today that matters is health. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can locate us on Twitter at WFYI. Well, I got a great group of guests today. I'd like to welcome to the program Kim Irwin, who is with Health by Design. Kim, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
It's good to have you here. And we also have with us Dr. Adrian Hutper, who is with the American College of Sports Medicine. In particular, he is the Vice President for Exercises Medicine. Adrian, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you here as well. And Dr. Lisa Harris, who is the CEO for Eskenazi Health. Good to have you here.
Well, and I will make it unanimous, and I'm delighted to be here.
All right.
Well, this is something that means a lot to me.
We're in agreement then. Well, I'm going to start here. You know, part of the premise of this show is that the numbers that come out about how healthy Hoosiers are aren't necessarily encouraging. So, Kim, I'm going to start with, could you give us kind of an overview, and I'm going to let Adrian and Lisa chime in as well, of how well we are doing in terms of maintaining basic health.
Sure. Well, I think, as you said, we all sort of know the headlines. We see report after report come out indicating that Hoosiers are not among the healthiest throughout our country. And I think, you know, it's easy to immediately jump into all of the reasons why that isn't the case. You know, we have high rates of smoking. We don't get enough physical activity. We don't necessarily eat the best foods. The work we do with Health by Design, which is really focused around the built environment in public health, uses an approach that we call policy, systems, and environmental change. And that's something that's come about in public health over the last several years. And it's kind of a wonky, it's kind of a wonky term, but it's important, I think, for people to understand that when we talk about policies, so whether that's legislative policies or informal workplace and school site policies, when we talk about the environment, what our environment looks like from an air quality standpoint, from a built environment, sidewalks, transit, you know, things like that, the environments in which we live, in which we go to school, in which we worship, those things matter. Systems change is a little more sort of nebulous, but when we talk about systems, we're really talking about processes and, again, implementation, say, of policies, how we get there. So I guess the comment I would make is that it's easy to jump right into the behavioral factors that influence why we're not healthy. Where I think we would benefit is to shift the conversation to the policies, systems, and environments that keep us potentially from optimizing our health. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with things like the fact that we consistently, as a state, rank among the bottom, like 48th to 50th for public health spending. We do not commit dollars to public health in this in this state. We don't maximize the dollars we can get through the federal government. We also have a small workforce around mm-hmm. public health, and I can't speak to the medical aspect as much of that, but particularly around broader community health types things, we just don't have the number of people in the field that would get us there. And so to me, those are examples of big picture issues that we need to address in order to be healthier.
Adrian and Lisa, what are some of the manifestations of this? I mean, what are the consequences of these kinds of health problems?
Well, the U.S. and this state as well with the rest of the U.S. is undergoing terrific burden, both economically and in health terms, for chronic diseases. So type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular risk factors and all those things that we know. And yet they're very, very connected to lifestyle. So there's something we can do something about. The bad news is we're not really doing enough about it. The good news is if we can just have the will collectively as a community to do something about it, we can change the needle here. We really can begin to it. And physical activity is one of the biggest determinants of how we can treat and manage chronic diseases, these things that really make a difference in our quality and our length of life.
Lisa.
Well, I would just add, I'm very happy about the way that we're launching this discussion, because from the perspective of healthcare, I think there's something I throw out that's the public model that really gets, you know, raises people's eyebrows when I say it. And this is that when we get to the point of treating disease, when we think about what we do in healthcare in terms of treating disease, throwing the entire biomedical model, all the technology, everything we have at our disposal toward treating disease, at that point, we have a 10% opportunity to reduce premature mortality. That is it. The other 90%, 50% is lifestyle, and it's our behaviors. And for most of us, that's the biggest is good nutrition and physical activity. It's also, you know, connection to the arts, connection to nature, social connection. There are many things that go into, you know, wellness and resilience. Another 20% is the environment, and that, you know, not just it's clean water, clean air. It's advocating on behalf of, you know, the built environment that supports health, you know, healthful behaviors, you know, safe places to walk, programs in schools that promote good nutrition and physical activity as part of the curriculum, so kids get that very early. The other 20% is genetic, and we used to think that was kind of the inherited risk that we were stuck with, and everything else we did was to try to mitigate, you know, to balance that risk. But now we know through the field of epigenetics that we even have an opportunity.
Probably explain what epigenetics
that,
are.
That basically is saying that that our behaviors can change some of our inherited genetic risk, in that our behaviors can upregulate some of our genes, downregulate others. So we even have an opportunity through our health behaviors
to
modify.
So there are behavior-related triggers then, even for your genetic.
Exactly, to modify our inherent genetic risk. And so that basically says that to a large, about 90% of it's on us. And it does go all the way from, you know, policies, resources, you know, devoting resources to the things that it takes to promote healthful behaviors, and then all the way to the healthcare community focusing on prevention, which is what we're all about at Eskenazi Health, because we know that our best opportunity to improve the health of our patients and by extension the health and vitality of our community is to work to do everything we can to keep people well in the first place.
We are talking about health here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or locate us on Twitter at WFYI. Maybe we ought to take a step back. And Lisa, I'm going to stay with you on this one. Is some of it, how should we define health? I mean, to a degree, you know, but we tend to think of it as a culture, I think, in almost negative terms. I'm healthy unless I'm falling over. I'm healthy unless I'm sick. I'm healthy unless there is some, you know, clearly discernible problem.
Well, that's a great question. And I think it's a matter of, it isn't simply the absence of disease, although that's obviously one easy way to think about it. But it's about vitality. It's about resilience. It's about the energy that with which we approach our day and how much energy we have left at the end of it. All those ways that, you know, that contribute to quality of life. And you can, you know, you can have, I think also health in the face of chronic disease. I mean, you can, there are many things that we know now about how, many chronic diseases are very manageable and that, you know, require healthcare interventions, you know, along the way. But by and large, there's a lot that we can do even in the face of disease to live healthfully and to live a vital, high quality life. That's the kind of thing that, that we all strive for and enjoy.
Adrian, how do you define health?
Yeah, I very much agree with what Lisa said. I think it's the first thing is from an economic point of view, we tend to think of it as an absence of disease. Do we see our doctor? And we're so busy, we often don't think about it until we go sick. But we really need to think about it is, does it give us the opportunity to enjoy life to the maximal? If we can really have enough health to really get the everything we want out of all our activities and enjoy the full benefits of what life's got to offer, I think we're pretty healthy. And we often don't think of that till we get disease. But the reality is that most of us could stand to be a bit, quote unquote, healthier in a sense that the side effects, for example, of physical activity, I do exercise for the side effects. I exercise because I want to feel better. I want to sleep better. I want my mood to be better. So that's why I exercise for the side effects.
Kim, I'm going to let you take a crack at that one, too. Define
sure.
health for
yes,
me.
Yes, absolutely. And again, I would definitely echo what Lisa and Adrian have said. I think a way to think about it is just to think of health being multidimensional. So we, again, usually default to physical health when mm-hmm. we talk about health. But there's also obviously a huge mental health and emotional health component. There's a spiritual health component. There's community health. Though, again, not just sort of how we are within our own bodies and minds, but how we interact with others and what that means. Do we have help? I love the word resilience in thinking about health. But, you know, do we have a network of social support, whether those that consists of people that we know or broader community-based resources that help us achieve that? And as Adrian said, I mean, these things all feed into each other, feed off of each other. And so when we think about eating healthy or getting physical activity, we know that it's not just about cardiovascular risk
reduction.
It's about so many other things.
What are the signs that you're not healthy? Kim, I'll stay with you.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I think, you know, things like overweight and obesity get a ton of attention. And while, you know, we've recently classified those as diseases in and of themselves, or obesity specifically, a lot of times what we talk about is the risk that comes from that. So we know that that tends to be a comorbid condition with diabetes, with cardiovascular disease, with even things like asthma, cancer itself. We don't often think of those as going together, but they do. But then also, again, looking at mental health, emotional health, and how doing things to advance one aspect of our health can have benefits to the others.
How do we define, like, in obesity? We throw these terms around, but there are people, I'm sure there's a clinical, what, you know, how should you consider yourself obese? What's the standard? Lisa, I'll throw that one to you. Is there, I mean, is there, and I realize we're not going to ask you to do a diagnosis over the air here yeah. for someone, but are there general guidelines, you know, if you're.
Well, we look at body mass index,
okay.
and that's the standard, the standard measure. And a body mass index of 30 or more is considered obese, 25 to 30 as overweight. And, you know, I would just throw out one number for those who want a sense of how, you know, what our challenges are. It's interesting. I think we could say 30% for about anything in depth, but 30% of kids are overweight. 33% of adults are obese, 31% of hypertension, like 29% of smoking. So if you say 30%, you're about there.
You're a point or two off on either side. Yeah.
Pardon? Yeah, yeah. You're close enough. Yeah. You're close enough.
Yeah.
And I think to both Kim and Adrian's point, while these numbers, these indices are helpful for, you know, measuring where we are on a continuum and measuring progress, it's more complicated than that, because someone who is slightly overweight, who is physically active, very well may have a better health profile than someone who is at normal or underweight who is sedentary. Yes. I mean, there's information that's come out recently about the effects of a sedentary lifestyle, meaning sitting more than 10 hours a day as opposed to less than 5 hours a day, and how that impacts your health risk, even if another 1 hour of that day you're spending it at the gym. Mm-hmm. So it is, it's all these things are interrelated, and it's not as simple as just looking at the weight and height, although certainly when you get into the category of obesity, there's definitely a challenge there that has to be addressed.
We are talking about health here on No Limits. My guests are Kim Irwin, Dr. Adrian Hutber, and Dr. Lisa Harris. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're kicking off Indie Talks today, a series of community conversations about things that matter, with a discussion about health. And my guests are Kim Irwin of Health by Design, Dr. Adrian Hutber, who is with the American College of Sports Medicine and is the VP there of Exercise is Medicine, and Dr. Lisa Harris, who is the CEO of Eskenazi Health. We were talking really about definitions of health. I want to drill down a little bit here. What are sort of the primary causes of an absence of health? I mean, I'm trying to to reframe the thing so that we're not talking about disease, we're talking about health, or we're, all of that. What are some of the primary causes? Adrian, I'll start with you.
Well, if we look in practical terms rather than in medical terms, I think that something that is very clear and really evident that what Lisa said earlier was it's our behaviors, that if we can just think about changing the behaviors that make a difference, then we don't have to think about the disease. We know that we're doing all we can to really make ourselves healthy. And if I can just add to something Lisa said, which is something that's great for people to remember, is not to get too focused on obesity. As important it is to be not obese, it's more important to be physically active. So in a catchphrase, it's better to be skinny and it's better to be fat and fit than skinny and unfit. Better to be fat and fit than skinny and unfit. Mm-hmm. So if people will just concentrate on their physical activity and making sure they're getting the right dosage, if you like, of physical activity, the obesity and other stuff, as long as you're eating sensibly, tends to take care of itself. And it tends to mean that you prevent yourself from getting all these other chronic diseases that come along with the lifestyle changes that you haven't been doing because you haven't been paying enough attention to it.
Kim, how much of this is a continuum or a related? I mean, I know from my my own experience, when I exercise more, when I'm much more active, it also changes the things that I'm hungry for too. And it, you know, my appetite, I may want a lot of food, but it may be different kind of food that tends to be healthier. I'm far less likely to go to McDonald's, for example. Not that, probably shouldn't throw McDonald's under the bus over the air, but I'm far less likely to go after the triple quarter pounder or whatever I'm doing that.
It's absolutely true, and I think to Adrian's point, very small things can make a huge difference, especially when we do them consistently and sort of incrementally build on them. So, you know, it's the first of the year. I'm sure the gyms are packed and everybody has New Year's probably most people, I'll say, have resolutions that relate to being healthier. And so we sort of see this huge attention given to it, lots of energy, you know, time and energy that people put into it. And unfortunately, it will fall off. So Mark Fenton, who's kind of a guru in the work that we do, talks about the stickiness factor. And he talks about interventions that help people be healthier and their relative stickiness. So a lot of times we talk about programs or even New Year's resolutions themselves tend to not be sticky. We can't assume that in July the same behaviors people have in January will stick.
What kinds of things do tend to be sticky?
Sure. So the work that we do around what we call active transportation, the idea of building physical activity into people's routine daily lives. So that could be walking to lunch instead of getting in our car to drive to lunch. It could be bike commuting. We work on what's called safe routes to school, so making it easier for kids to walk and bike to school. And just 10-minute bursts of physical activity are so important. And if you can do that twice a day, three times a day, you know, four times a day, that's so valuable. And yet we don't think of that as exercise, right? So mm-hmm. we even talk about reframing exercise as physical activity, because if I walk to lunch, mm-hmm. I'm getting physical activity.
And Lisa, how... It seems to me that there's a certain inertia. I mean, part of the problem with an absence of health or people when they aren't healthy is that the behaviors have taken root, and the problem keeps getting worse. And at least in my case, I know in times when I've let my exercise routine lapse and, you know, started doing things that weren't necessarily healthy, the further you go along that path, the more intimidating it seems mm-hmm. about trying to find a way back, because, you know, particularly mm-hmm. once you're of a certain age, starting to get back into shape may not be entirely comfortable or pain-free. Mm-hmm. So how should one mm-hmm. start?
Well, the good news is that your body is always ready. Mm-hmm. So even if you haven't been on that path for a while, it's ready once you get started. And as a couple things that Kim was talking about, one, in terms of changing behavior, something I work with, I still see patients as part of my practice, my day or my week. And I spend most of my time working with them trying to help them adopt more healthful behaviors. And it's actually more about establishing new behaviors than necessarily changing old ones, and it's fine. We have triggers for bad behaviors. Mm-hmm. Since you started, I'll just say, you know, we've seen, you know, the arches, and that's a trigger. Any fast food is a trigger. It's right there, you know, as we're, going back and forth. But working with folks to deliberately find new triggers and the built environment, you know, Kim was talking about the importance of the built environment. That's why it's important to have stairs. Easy, mm-hmm. you know, stairs right next to the elevators where you can see them. So as I'm working with patients, I'll say, you know, you have to deliberately, first of all, set up that trigger. And then once you have done it, once you have taken the stairs instead of the elevator, when you're done, when you get up to the top, make a big to-do about it. You know, congratulate yourself, you know, give yourself a big high five, you know, and think about how good you feel, your heart's pumping, how that as you're doing it, you know, deliberately think about how, or if you're taking the next step and you're getting up and you're running in the morning. You know, think about how much better you feel at the end of the day. Deliberately think about how that how your energy lasted till the end of the day, and attribute that mm-hmm. to that early morning run. So that the next time that you're debating about whether you want to get out of bed at, you know, it's dark and it's cold, you remember you have, and you have to work. But if you do that reliably, it will change. That there is a science around behavior change that you are establishing pathways in your brain that will trigger, that will carry forth that behavior. But it does require that conscious, big, you know, acknowledgement and celebration, and it can't be overdone. It can't possibly be too much, too overdone, to reinforce.
Should feel
to
like
establish
Rocky at the top of the
exactly. No, exactly. That's exactly yeah. right. Yeah. I mean, I do that when I put my keys in the right place when I get home. So, and I remind myself now, having done that. Tomorrow, when I'm, you know, trying to get out the door and I'm running late, I don't have to search for my keys. I know they're going to be right there. That's you know, kind of practically what it takes.
Well, Kim had mentioned earlier, and I should say we're talking about health here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. You also can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Kim, you'd mentioned that here in Indiana, we don't spend a whole lot on public health in comparison with other states. And I guess the question, I would assume that we'd start with a premise, and I'll ask all three of you that a person's health is primarily that person's responsibility. But who else should share in that? You know, what other systems of support should there be in place? And since you raised the subject, Kim, I'm going to toss it back to you first.
Sure. Okay. Well, I absolutely believe that we have a collective responsibility around health, in much the same way that we, I would say generally, not in all cases, but tend to believe that things like education and taking care of the poor and even other networks like transportation and sewer and, you know, that kind of thing, that we believe that those are things that are part of the public good. I think, unfortunately, that's become a very political hot button almost. But if we can accept that we all bear the cost of unhealthy people, then I think it can help maybe think about how we can reframe responsibility for that in a way that makes it easier. We say a lot, we're trying to make the healthy choice the easy choice. And in the vast majority of settings, schools, office buildings, even our homes, the healthy choice is rarely the easy choice.
How do you go about making the healthy choice the easy choice? Mm-hmm. What are ways that you do that?
So things like having sidewalks is critical to making a healthy choice an easy choice. If I have the option to walk to where I'm going to go because it's within proximity and I have safe infrastructure that allows me to do that, I may need encouragement to start that behavior, but once I realize, oh my gosh, I can actually walk to the store when I'm picking up milk and cereal and walk back home, and it's, you know, again, part of my daily routine and it's good quality time with my kids and, you know, whatever, then we're more likely to do that behavior again. I feel like it's a really good example, are like office meetings. You know, we a lot of times have candy and donuts in the break room or candy and donuts at meetings. We're having a 9 o'clock meeting. We have to have coffee and we have to have donuts. Well, if there are not donuts in the room, but instead there are fruit, people will choose fruit. If you have donuts and fruit, lots of people will still choose the fruit. But the environment, if there are only donuts, people are more likely to eat a donut than to eat nothing, kind of thing. So simple thing, what I would call simple things like that, even though they absolutely require intention and sort of new inertia in a positive way, it can make a huge difference.
How much of this, Adrian, do you think should be we've talked about sort of a community and corporate, a government, you know, what could government do to promote healthier lifestyles? Is there anything?
Yeah, this is gets very political, isn't it? I think that...
Well, we have conversations with no limits here, so...
Yeah, I see the government's role as helping to make it as easy as possible for us to make the right choices. So for us to do the things, we can make right choices for individual behaviors. But like as Kim said, there's many things we really can't do if we don't have a good environment, if we don't have, when we're at work or at schools, if we don't have them providing us with the ability to make great choices. And if they're not encouraging that, and if their policies don't encourage that, we're fighting an uphill battle. So we're fighting ourselves and we're fighting our environment. So I absolutely see it as the government. And when I say government, I just don't mean federal government. I mean local and community governments' ability and willingness to put in place policies that will encourage and make it easy for these behaviors.
Lisa, I see you nodding your head up and down. So I'm going to give you a shot at talking about this too.
Well, I know you wanted to talk about good news.
Yeah.
And so I think we have examples of good news in our community. Mayor Ballard and his initiative with the bike trails. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are bike trails everywhere. And I've heard rumors of one that will be connecting Eagle Creek to downtown. We already have the cultural trail, which connects folks from, you know, the quadrants, the far quadrants, and actually beyond Marion County, where folks can, you know, as Adrian said, get downtown under their own power. Mm-hmm. Something that we've done at Eskenazi Health, we have bike lockers and we have showers that would be that are accessible. Mm-hmm. So if people want to come, you know, and spend a day in downtown, they can come, take a shower, lock their bike there, and enjoy, you know, White River State Park or the downtown environment from, you know, from across the four quadrants. So that's where I think that's a positive example of where, you know, local government is getting behind this and community, you know, an engaged community and philanthropy, the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Glicks, all of those who contributed to the cultural trails. I think those are the kinds of things that are getting people out to walk because not only is it, you know, a nice, safe, paved infrastructure, but there are interesting things to see along the way. There are destinations. And so I think that there are a lot of things that are in the works, and I'm starting to see people more and more avail themselves of those opportunities.
We've gotten a question, or more of a comment, from a listener via Facebook. It says, due to the design of our road network, we've excluded walking, cycling, et cetera, so people don't have those options. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're seeing some small steps, obviously, mm-hmm. as we've talked about, the cultural trail, bike trails here in Indianapolis. Let me, you know, I'll start with Adrian on this one. Let me put you in charge of everything here in Indiana for a moment.
Oh, thank you.
How would you redesign our sort of infrastructure so that it would make the easy choice, or the healthy choice, the easy choice?
Wow, that's a very complex question. I don't know if I've got the expertise to answer that, but I think that the implementation of policies that promote sidewalks and green space definitely help on that. But I would say that it goes more beyond that, because you can actually do that within the walking space outside. But, you know, a lot of listeners, I'm sure, probably think, well, I hate walking. Mm-hmm. I hate walking. I'd rather do something else. So whatever, we've got to find ways of making people be able to engage in what they find fun, because that's what they're going to change behaviors. So, and some of that is going to be in the office space. It's going to be in the schools as well. So it's really going to demand engagement and teaching both within the school environment and within the office environment, teaching the HR folks to really think about and take responsibility for actually doing stuff and maybe changing what's typical in American businesses, the way that we've always done it, into ways that are innovative to actually change people's behavior in that workspace. Otherwise, by default, people will just do what they've always done.
We are talking about health here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please call us at 1-866-476-3881. Kim, same question. I'm going to make you master of everything here. You know, how do we go about improving overall health?
Sure. And I will just comment specific to the comment that was made. I absolutely get that. I appreciate it. And the reality is that for many, many people in our community, it is not an option today to walk to the store, as I said, or to walk to go to lunch, to bike commute. That is the work we do through Health by Design, is working on policy systems and environmental change that will get us there. Things like complete streets and safe routes to school, and just a real look, you know, IndyConnect, how we increase transportation options so that people can choose to be active. You know, I think beyond that, again, I know a lot of my public health background is coming through here, but there's another sort of broad approach that we use, which is health in all policies. And it's something that can actually be a policy in and of itself. A city like Indianapolis could adopt a policy that says we are going to look at health in all policies. And what that means is anytime you're doing something, a city government, a state government, a federal government is doing something, we're thinking about what are the implications for health, for those broad dimensions of health in what we're doing. And there are trade-offs, absolutely. But if we don't ever think about it, which I think happens the most of the time now, we're never going to make the progress we need. So I feel like it's a huge step, but it's also sort of very simple, is we have to be willing to think about health impacts in every aspect of decision-making we make on a sort of municipal level, even if it doesn't seem like it's health-related.
How much of it, I mean, we tend to look at this, and we alluded to this earlier in the show when we talked about, you know, the definition of health, that sort of cultural one. How much of this is going to be about changing the terms of the discussion, that that health is something other than the absence of disease, and getting people to start from that premise rather than the other one? Kim, I'll stick with you.
I think that's huge, and I love that. I love that about Indy Talks, that we are even having this discussion, that we've sort of looked at a theme for 2014 that includes health. And I feel a lot of responsibility. I mean, I personally feel responsible, and in my job, I feel like this is what we do every day. But I'd love to, you know, engage so many others in doing that. And I'll just say, you know, we work with community members a lot. They have a voice. If you're listening and you want sidewalks where you live, you need to let your counselor know, the mayor know, and your mayor's neighborhood liaison know, because that is the first step towards getting change.
We are talking about health here on No Limits. My guests are Kim Irwin, Adrian Hutber, and Lisa Harris. I'm John Krall. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about health today on No Limits. We're kicking off Indy Talks, which is a community-wide conversation about things that matter. My guests are Kim Irwin with Health by Design, Adrian Hutber, who is with the American College of Sports Medicine, is the VP of Exercise Is Medicine there, and Lisa Harris, who is the CEO for Eskenazi Health. If you would like to join the conversation, please do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, Steve. Welcome to the program.
Oh, yeah. Hi. Sorry. My comment is about sidewalks and walking in Indianapolis. Last year, my company encouraged us all to get more exercise and gave us Fitbits so we could track our walking. And then I realized in my neighborhood there's no sidewalks. So I called my city county council person and the mayor's helpline, I think it's called. Well, I'm not sure where that goes because they want a specific street address where there's a problem. And I think, well, it's the whole zip code. You know, it's just you literally cannot walk safely from one part of town to another one, and the bus service seems spotty enough, at least in my neighborhood, where you know, you'd have to walk sort of on the road where the trees grow right up to the roadway, for example. I'm not sure where to take it from here, but I wish that there was a concerted effort to get sidewalks put into, I think it's probably the old unincorporated areas before Unigov mm-hmm. came into being.
Yeah.
Now I see it.
Thanks very much for the call, Steve. Well, we probably ought to first answer a question for those who don't speak health and fitness speak. What is a Fitbit that he made a reference to? Kim?
Sure. A Fitbit is basically a step counter, and it includes an accelerometer, which basically means it's measuring motion and can do height or like steps. It can tell if you're doing steps as well. But yeah, it's another tool that individuals can use to help sort of get a sense of their physical activity in a day. There are lots of ways to do that. And 10,000 steps mm-hmm. a day is the recommended amount. And so it sort of helps you track that.
Go ahead.
I could just quickly, for anybody, our Health by Design website is info@healthbydesignonline.org. That'll come straight to me. And if you have questions about a specific part of town or specific sort of ways the process works, please get in touch. We can't promise anything. It is a very slow, tedious process, but we're trying.
We've also gotten an email question from a listener named Lee. And if you would like to send us an email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. She says, my doctors seem quick to want to prescribe a drug to address health issues when I'd rather determine if natural remedies like changes and diet might make a difference. Personally, I'd like for pharmaceuticals to be a last resort. How can a person find a doctor who has more training with nutrition? Adrian, I'll start with you on that one, primarily. because Lisa's got a cough, if you hear that in the background.
Thank you, Adrian. Thank you. I think the medical school education currently is that physicians don't have a lot of nutrition training, either that or physical activity. So it's not traditionally been part of our medical curriculum. And that's one of the things we, with many other organizations, are trying to change. But the way things are right now is you're really going to have to go and, if you like, and interview your doctor. You're going to have to go and talk to them. And I think that we've got to be realistic here. The doctor knows risk factors and when things are problematic, and we shouldn't be encouraging or advising people to dispense with or not take traditional medicine. What we should be doing is trying to link with a doctor who, at the same time as they're giving medicines, will prescribe other things that can perhaps decrease our dependence upon medication. So, for example, I was talking to a president of a college recently, and his wife had type 2 diabetes, and she was on a medication, as was appropriate. Mm-hmm. However, after a couple of years, her doctor declared that she really didn't need medication anymore because the physical activity and nutrition program that she had embarked on was sufficient to reduce that. So I would say always do it in consultation with your doctor, and realistically, we're probably going to have to do both at the same time.
We are talking about health here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Lee, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, Lee. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, Yes, thank you. That was actually a fabulous segue into my comment. I actually am a dietitian, and I see all diabetes patients for nutrition education in their homes, and obviously a lot of comorbidities and co-founding disease states there. But what I find very frustrating from both a patient and a practitioner point of view is exactly that referral process from the medical professionals to the other auxiliary healthcare professionals that are out there. And it's totally unrealistic for everyone to know what's covered under every insurance plan, but to have a general knowledge of what things potentially would be covered, like Medicare covered nutrition education for diabetes at 100%. You would be amazed at the number of nurses and physicians that I speak with that have no idea that that's a covered service. And so a lot of times I feel like nutrition and exercise, since it is such a behavioral modification thing and the responsibilities put in the patient's hands, that those services, I don't want to say get poo-pooed, but especially if they're expected to not be covered by insurance, that that's not a step that people naturally go for. So it becomes very, very frustrating for all parties involved.
Thank you very much for the call and the question, Lisa, I'll throw it to you. Sure. I got that confused.
Well, I'd go back to something Adrian said and say that, you know, I think to some extent, medical education is catching up with this approach. And as a, you know, Eskenazi Health is a major teaching hospital for the School of Medicine, so we do have an investment in working with our learners so that they appreciate this as one of the first arms, you know, the first arrows in their quiver, so to speak, as we're approaching chronic disease management. And as part of that, I think the other thing is making. I think Lee referred to the issue of ease of referral and mm-hmm. sort of reducing barriers. And so I think it's important to have as many members of the healthcare team available in that primary care setting. So we actually have a program called the Healthy Me program we've had for 10 years that takes both the health counselors, the behavioral motivational interviewers, the personalized health coaches are available right at the primary care site. So when the primary care physician recognizes that a patient would benefit from lifestyle management, the issue is that, in primary care visits, there's relatively little time as we're caring from, many patients in a day. So it helps to have these other members of the team, likely with this extra expertise, who are part of the team who we can refer patients to right in the context of that visit and get that personalized, health and lifestyle coaching.
This may seem like a silly question, but it occurs to me, and it's on point. How should one use, in terms of maintaining a lifestyle, a healthy lifestyle, how should one use one's doctors? In the sense that, many of us think, okay, I'll go see the doctor when I'm not feeling well, and then we'll address the symptom. What is a good and sensible way to use your medical support services?
Well, and again, I like the reference to medical support services because I think it is a physician and an entire healthcare team. And we're working more toward better use. I think historically everything went mm-hmm. to the physician, whether that was the person best equipped to manage that particular problem or intervene at that particular point or not. And so now we have this bevy, this team of dietitians, of folks who are mental health, counselors, of various therapists, physical therapists, again, health coaches, folks who are trained in motivational interviewing to help people work specifically on behavioral change. And I think that whole team with the, the healthcare, the doctor or the nurse mm-hmm. practitioner at the center is what it's going to take really start to be able to have an impact. And we're actually demonstrating the utility of that through this Healthy Me Project. It's just one example of things that are going on all across Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about health here on No Limits. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. My question is this. I what I observe is that there's people who are struggling with obesity, even mild obesity, a lot of times are very focused on how difficult it is to make changes, how much of a pain it is to exercise, or the discomfort involved, or how hard it is to stick to it, and that there's not so much emphasis on the positive benefits that they'll get and how much better they'll feel. And I'm wondering if this is kind of a failure in the public health message, that there's not enough information out there given to people about the connection between depression and obesity, or just how much easier it is to navigate life and feel good when you're more fit and not carrying weight around. What is your feeling about that?
I see Adrian and Kim both nodding their heads. I'm going to go with Adrian.
All right, well, I'll start then. I think that's right. I think we're learning a lot about messaging people from industry and stuff like that, and I don't think within the healthcare industry we've traditionally done a very good. We've almost taken a scare people approach, which is tell them all the negatives and they're bound to change. Well, we know now from more we know about behavior that people don't change for those reasons. So we have to begin to tell people the benefits. People do things because they like to do it. People do it because it's fun to do it. And we need to start changing the message, because for those people that have already gone to the doctor because they've got a disease, they're really motivated at that point to change. But for the people who haven't gone to the doctor yet, they're going to be much more motivated by the positive messaging. So the call is absolutely right. We need to start messaging, in my opinion, in positive terms, and tell these people what's in it for them, not try to scare them.
Kim, how, because that is part of it. People do get scared of the idea of exercising. How much of this is the trick also of just finding an exercise routine that is fun, that's something that's enjoyable? I mean, is it something as simple as you know, instead of doing the Stairmaster, just making sure you take the dog out for a walk or something like that?
Mm-hmm. I don't think there's one answer. I think every person has to figure out what works best for them, what fits with the rest of their life in terms of schedule and funds and that kind of thing, as well as ultimately what is fun. Some people are extremely motivated by being around others when they're exercising. Other people want to do it solo kind of thing. And so I think part of probably why why I think the motivational interviewing or finding sort of a resource who can help people work through that when they're embarking on something on this change can be really important, because it does sort of help focus. Okay, what are my goals around? What am I trying to get out of it? And what's the best way, what's the best way not just to get going, but to stick, right? Back to stickiness. And that's going to be different for every person, really.
We are talking about health here on No Limits. Art, welcome to the program.
Greetings.
Greetings. What's on your mind?
For some time, I've been talking about and gotten resonance from people on the idea that if employers and the medical providers all worked for different incentives to support wellness as opposed to specifically fighting disease after it has occurred, or medical problems after they've occurred, that then if they did that, then the incentives would flow down to the employees, who then would be inspired, along with, as you were just saying, emphasizing the positive and how enjoyable it can be to be doing the right thing. And I have a benefits counselor friend that, in the space of about 15 months, contacted about 40 or 45 companies that comprised between 12 and 13,000 employees, and got them all on programs of that sort, where they were wellness programs, where the providers were being compensated for wellness, not for solution of illness problems, and where the employers saw their premiums go down, the number of people who were insurable went up. The whole situation got better for that whole pool of people.
Well, I can tell, Art, that you are preaching to Lisa here. She seems to be in agreement, so I'm going to let her respond to that. Thank you very much for the call.
Well, absolutely. I'm very happy that you launched us into this area of discussion, because this is something that's, I think, lost in all the discussion about healthcare reform right now, where we're thinking about the challenges to access, although that's improving, and we're obviously all for expanded coverage and better access to care. The other big piece about health reform is payment reform, which aligns incentives in the way that you're discussing. So health care systems that have previously been, had incentives to do more procedures because they got paid on a fee-for-service basis. So the more cardiovascular surgeries they did, the more you know, interventions, the more tests, that's how health yeah. systems
bring
were
on,
paid.
Bring on the heart attack.
Yeah, so there was no real incentive to work to keep people yeah. well. Well, now we're moving toward rewards for value as opposed to volume and managing the health of a population effectively. So it all drives mm-hmm. back to getting as upstream as possible and focusing on prevention, earlier intervention, effective chronic disease management, the kinds of things you're talking about that these wellness programs support. And now we have aligned incentives between, you know, payers, employers, and health systems all focused on the same goal, which is working to reduce the burden of illness, improve health, it is the case that with redirecting the resources to, you know, prevention, earlier intervention, we will have, first of all, the health outcomes that we want as individuals mm-hmm. and as a community, as a nation, at a cost that is affordable, because it's pennies on the dollar when you're focusing on preventive medicine as opposed to tertiary and quaternary, the end stage of disease treatment.
We're starting to get close on time, so I want to ask a question, just overarching, if you can define it quickly. And Adrian, I'll start with you. What does a healthy community look like?
I think a healthy community is where people who are willing to take responsibility for their own health care have access to the resources they need to do it.
Kim, how about you? What does a healthy community look like?
Sure. Well, it has sidewalks everywhere, so we'll go with that. That active transportation infrastructure is a huge piece, and that's obviously what our work is around. But I think access is the word that I would always use. Access to fresh fruits and vegetables. You know, we haven't talked a lot about the food aspect, but food deserts are...
And we've gotten some emails emphasizing the nutrition piece
sure.
of this.
That... So access to fresh fruits and vegetables, access to medical care, I think access to mental health care services. And again, I think there's something about that social cohesion, the idea mm-hmm. that we're all in it together and we have maybe not a responsibility, but life is better if we're looking out for each other.
And Lisa, you got about 15 seconds to have the last
word. Well, and that's all
here.
I need, because everything's been said. I would just say it's you know, a healthy community is one that's vibrant, that you know that exhibits resilience, that demonstrates a responsibility to everyone living within the community to support the health and vitality of all of our neighbors. I think that's what to me means a healthy community.
Good last word. I would like to thank my guests, Kim Irwin, Adrian Hutber, and Lisa Harris. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. I will talk with you again on Thursday. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alsett. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.